Have you not seen Cool Runnings?
No, but I've heard of Cool Whip.
Right. Anyway.
Hello and welcome to The Rotten Underdog. This is a podcast where we talk about movie trends and everything, movies that people either tend to miss or don't talk about or, you know, or we want to talk about because we don't think about anyone else.
Episode one, yay.
Yeah, this is actually the first episode.
Episode one.
Yeah, episode zero is basically a special episode, and any episode that comes after episode one would probably be an episode 1.1, where we'll be either talking about, you know, a roundup of the movies that released in the month, and you know, exchanging notes. But this is basically the whole and soul important episode where we're just going to be, you know, exploring quite a few things, right? And with me is Kevin.
Hello.
Kevin is a geek, a journalist, everything.
A filmmaker and like yourself, a film critique. I don't know if you are.
Yeah, a film critic.
Yeah, film critic, basically, yeah.
So, here goes. Kevin watched a movie and I watched a movie, and both of them were based on true stories. So I definitely want to take a look at that because I've had a lot of problems with movies based on true stories, and it's just been annoying me how cut and dry they are, and I just want to talk about like films that don't necessarily need to be docudramatized or reenactments that could otherwise just be a Netflix documentary series or an HBO documentary series or whatever. What else are we talking about?
We'll be talking about 90 years of Mickey Mouse, actually.
Okay.
And generally a good roundup on the Walt Disney Company and where does the mass media company go from here?
Right.
And speaking of mass media companies, we're going to go obviously the next generation of mass media, streaming media, and we'll be talking about the pretty cool stuff that Netflix been doing recently as well. And I'm actually just blown away how a company that was just meant to like this is the company that killed Blockbuster, if you think about it, right?
Yeah.
Be Kind, Rewind, no longer exists. And that's the thing, like, reality is often stranger than fiction now. Like,
oh, absolutely.
Like, I don't remember the last time I used cable. Like, I generally don't remember the last time I actually watched. When I say watch things on television, I meant, like, cable TV.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, because a lot of the companies around the world are either choosing IPTV as their main, as their go-to live TV service, or going for, you know, streaming services. You know, there's Netflix, there is and Disney Plus is about to come out, there's just so much stuff that, you know, TV is kind of like in this whole new revolutionary era.
Yeah, like when you say you're gonna watch the TV, it's no longer you're watching the telly anymore. It's like you're watching the device called the TV. You're not watching television as you know it. You're gonna be watching something else on TV, right?
Yeah, but you know, I feel like television as a medium has definitely changed, and the definition is the same, but how we end up having the kind of output that we have right now, that's what's changed.
Yeah. So, getting into it, obviously, since we're talking about realities.
Yep.
So I saw Bohemian Rhapsody.
You did.
Twice, actually. Which was I wanted you to see it as well. And you haven't watched it quite yet.
I haven't seen it yet.
And it's quite a shame though, because they only had like one screening for Dolby over
right
here. And this is a film that you have to watch in a sound specific cinema. Like even if you want to take this film home, I'd rather you get your best audio on this.
Well, I think I do have,
yeah,
you know, good enough audio from.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I can see your system. It's quite nice, but the thing with this film, like I'm not reviewing this film today, but I'm so torn because as a Queen fan, I really thought it didn't hit all the right notes. This film has been polarizing in so many levels, and like let's not even get to the fact that Bryan Singer directed and then got removed off the project, and the second thing being that this film was initially planned to be made back in 2011 when it was being developed by Sacha Cohen Baron, who in fact
Sacha Baron Cohen, by the way.
Sorry, my bad. Sacha Baron Cohen. You are going to edit this out, so I'm going to when Sacha Baron,
I probably might keep it.
I hate you. Sacha Baron Cohen was in this, and basically he left the project midway on amicable terms with Brian May and Roger Taylor, the two of the surviving members of Queen, and they wanted this film to make it more about themselves as opposed to Freddie Mercury. Now, I'll be straight up honest. They made amazing music that defined a generation and continues to define a generation, because this film is now making people like millennials right now. Like people like, I mean, I was already listening to Queen, but there are a few. Like, in fact, there were people in the cinema. They surprised me because they didn't know two key things. One, Freddie Mercury died. And two, what he died of.
Right.
Like people did not know that.
But did they cover it, or did they just, you know, make it a footnote?
Regarding his AIDS diagnosis, it was, I'd say, a major part in the film towards the end.
Well, then that's good, right?
Yeah, they glossed over a lot of what was his sexuality and his relationships and stuff. His key relationship with, so he had like key relationships in his life, but one of them was with Mary, obviously.
Yeah.
And that is focused on a lot. And I said, a lot of what happens in Bohemian Rhapsody, so they made one thing very clear. Like, they were very upfront about this. Like, this film is celebrating his journey as opposed to being a biopic. It looks, in marketing, it looks like a biopic, because if you see the film post, it's only Freddie. There's no other part of the band there.
Right.
And in fact, I remember reading like someone's opinion piece on this film, because it's four parts of something, but one part that stands out. And when he says this, ironically, because Queen, the one part that stood out was Freddie Mercury as a person,
right?
And when you do films like this, where the focus is on, and bless Rami Malek, because he has done an amazing job. And in fact, they got like one of the singers, they've endorsed him to be the Freddie Mercury tribute singer, Mark Mattel, who I could swear sounds 90% like Freddie Mercury. And in fact, the tracks have been remastered. It's epically done. In fact, the whole thing culminates at Live Aid. I don't know if you know the context of that.
One of
the best, most watched concerts of all time, basically.
Oh, okay.
And well, there's no spoilers really in this film, because at the end of the day, when you look at this film, a lot of people get confused and think that this is a biopic, which is now coming to our point of contention here in this conversation. A lot in this film has been dramatized, and many of the characters don't really get to tell their stories because they're no longer with us in reality, you know?
Okay, but is it coherent? Because I think that, like, you know, a lot of the... and by coherent, I mean emotionally coherent. Because I personally feel that a lot of these biopics, they miss out so much on emotional coherence.
Yeah.
In the sense that, like, you know, they'll show the bunch of events that took place. They'll dramatize them. They'll reenact them. But they just don't have the kind of, you know, emotional coherence to transition from one scene to another and still give us like a sort of like a feel that we're watching something continuous.
So when you talk about coherence, no, it misses out, because this is a medley. It's not necessarily like...
Yeah, so biopic got a biopic.
Yeah, it's very cookie cutter. And like any in the cookie, when you're mass producing films like this, like it follows a pattern which you are obviously going to talk about right now. But this pattern is so thematic, because like, you know, there's a rise and a fall, and then there's a rise again. But, and in this case, with Freddie Mercury's Like we don't see his passing, by the way. We don't see any of that. And one thing is for sure, though, because as part of him, they respected him as a character, I'd say, as a real-life character, because he's a very private person. And there was not much they could use and go on, in fact. Like, I'd say, like, out of the inputs of all the Queen members, there are three surviving members right now. Only two were involved in production. The other one was totally out of the loop. And that's the thing. When you create stories of individuals who had these fantastic histories and they're no longer here to tell us, there's no way of verifying what happened. And in fact, like, a lot of articles you'll see now will be writing about how they gloss over his bisexuality, how they gloss over the timelines of when he got diagnosed. All of these are not actually correct or accurate in the film. And yeah, at the end of the day, they just wanted to make a film that tributed to Freddie, how he felt during these key periods of his life. And at the end of the day, he went out with a bang, and that's pretty much how the film goes.
Okay, I guess, I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
Did you find any, I don't know, difference in tonal differences in scenes? Because as we know, that Dexter Fletcher was roped into.
Yeah, you could see that some of the scenes were missing in impact, basically. Especially, I think because Fletcher came in towards the end of the film, just to wrap up the Live 8 scenes, and if I'm not mistaken. So it's during that time. So the Live 8 scene, so I think that scene, that it's very poignant in that sense, because that would be the film that would be the scene that you'd watch specifically for this movie, because I had goosebumps listening to that last end credits scene, because it's basically them jamming out their hits to Wembley Stadium. And just to see that sheer scale, like, people obviously would say, like, yeah, that's the time, like, I remember watching this on television. Like, a lot of the 80s kids who I know saw this when they were, what, 6 or 7. And this obviously brought back a lot of memories. And for people who listen to Queen, if you look at individual aspects of this film, they nail it on the wall. But as a group, and, like, the sum does not equal all of its parts, you know? That's what they're trying to get at, pretty much, in the situation. And it doesn't add up. Like, you can have individual performances of the cast, you can have individual performances of the music. When it all comes down together, like, even, like, the most hardcore Queen fans would probably tell you, like, no, I wasn't impressed. And I guess that's a very tough act, because Freddie Mercury is a tough act to follow, honestly. It's a very difficult thing to do, if you think about it. But they came close. And to their credit, if I'm thinking as the manager of the band right now, I'm like, hey, this film is getting people to listen to our songs. More royalties means more money. And more money means, like, there's going to be a market for making more biopics for films, like, for more musicians, which I'm all for. But let's have good films, you know?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think that's a problem with movies based on true stories and what they essentially do to them, because, like you said, with Bohemian Rhapsody, it's a medley of events.
Yeah.
It doesn't really have a coherent storyline that makes you feel like it's a film. It's just a few sketches, you know, if we're talking internet language. I just watched this movie called Private War.
Yeah.
A few weeks back, and got Rosamund Pike from Gone Girl. For those who don't, get the name, she's a fantastic actor. I think that she did a great job as as the person actually that this movie actually focuses on, and. The idea is that, like, there are some flourishes in the film, you know, where it kind of, so she's a war journalist, and she goes and she covers wars, and she feels for these people, and yeah, sure, it's very white savory in a lot of places, but one of the most interesting aspects of it was when you are I guess it's a creative representation, but, like, you're given an insight into her mind and the PTSD that she consistently has after every, you know, after every war covered, or after, you know, every event that impacts her or influences her. And but that's about it. You know, that there is nothing. It's just like a couple of boom, 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 boom. That's it. Like, oh, okay, cool. Movie starts. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 bullet points. End. And this is a problem with so many biopics, that it gets on my nerves. And then they have like a weird you know, text epilogue of a kind,
yeah,
like a footnote. And
exactly,
I don't want footnotes. I want a movie. Okay, I don't have a problem with footnotes. I think just, you know, go and have all the footnotes you want, but just like make a movie. You know, documentary reenactments, you know, they might as well just exist in documentaries. I'd rather watch a documentary. I mean, like the Mr. Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor.
Yeah,
I thought that was a fantastic, extremely well made, extremely well paced, almost like a storytelling, almost like storytelling, like, you know, actual proper storytelling 101.
Isn't Jim Carrey doing something right now with Mr. Rogers?
Jim Carrey's doing something on the, like, that's kind of loosely based on Mr. Rogers, I guess. But like, I think they're talking more depression and the downfall, or the psychological downfall of it. I think it's called Kidding. It's on Showtime.
Yeah, yeah, it's Kidding, right?
But Mr. Rogers, basically, it's a documentary that like has you know, three acts. It feels like a proper, you know, movie that tells a story. And you know, that's saying something, considering it's a documentary compared to a lot of movies based on true stories that just don't feel like films.
Yeah, and like, obviously we have these films, like, I'd say, because when you say, let's think about this for a second. Like, we have Lincoln, which is basically a film that is basically written, let's give this film an Oscar straight up. Yeah. It's political, it's American, and I think he developed a formula, basically, when you say that film, basically. I keep forgetting the director for Lincoln, but
it's Steven Spielberg.
Spielberg, right? Yeah. And when you see these films all following a similar pattern, but then I guess one could argue that most biopics have, why do they become biopics in the first place? You know?
Well, they're definitely biographical pictures.
Yeah, each individual has defined a generation. The stories become defining because of the struggles they go through. They reach a certain point and then they collapse. But that, you can obviously, like, there are obviously films like Eddie the Eagle, which I know you personally loved.
I absolutely loved Eddie
and
the Eagle.
If you think about Eddie the Eagle, really, that story was an amazingly relatable story, for the sheer fact that there's this guy who did something just because he could have, and he did. And that story doesn't have any high endings or whatever. It's just like, it's just the fact that there was this one fellow crazy enough to do something stupid to get himself involved. And in fact, even even in that biopic, half of it was not even accurate. But that Absolutely. Was not the point of the biopic at the end of it, right? It didn't take itself seriously. It was so self-aware that they wanted to make a feel-good film.
Absolutely. And the fact that it was so traditional in a sense of its storytelling, they didn't do anything new. It was a basic A to Z storytelling experience, and it was just so well made. It was so emotionally involving. I think I cry every time I watch it. I've watched it thrice, and it's been a journey every time.
Like, it really depends how you want your biopic to be. It doesn't have to be all that serious. Like,
right.
So Bohemian Rhapsody is a musical biopic.
Yeah.
Private War was your usual dramatized.
Yeah, dramatized political documentary drama, style whatever, drama, yeah.
Which we see a lot of. But films like Eddie the Eagle for me stood out because they involve comedy as well.
Right.
I, Tonya was dark comedy as well.
I, Tonya was amazing. As a dark comedy. Fantastic.
Cool Runnings, which is a film that very few people actually talk about. Cool Runnings is that film we all saw. I saw it on VHS.
Okay, what's what?
Cool Runnings. Have you not seen Cool Runnings?
No, but I've heard of Cool Whip.
Right. Anyway. So, Cool Runnings.
Are you going to be stuck with the... you know, are you going to be stuck hearing the term Cool Whip?
Yeah, it's going to be in my head now. Thank you. Yeah. Okay.
Of course. Thanks. You're welcome. You know.
So, Cool Runnings obviously was one of those films that Disney made.
Yeah.
In fact, and I was very surprised, like, they made this film and they changed the format into comedy. Oh. Because, like, Jamaicans themselves are, like, the feel-good people of
right.
the Caribbean. And to make a film about them, and I would... Can you imagine Cool... I don't know, you haven't seen it.
No, I really haven't.
You should, actually. It's one of those old-timey films that was typical. It was done in the days of Disney making these cool films. Like, these cool, like, very nice comedy, family-fun film.
Right.
Templated films. So Cool Running stood out because it was actually based on a true story. And true story is more serious than it is, but they've actually adapted this for a comedy...
Yeah.
Comedy, motivational drama type series. And one of the things about that is that they actually stuck to the script and they actually incorporated... They didn't overly dramatize a lot of these things because most of them were actually accurate.
Huh.
And I would say 90% accuracy in terms of story alone.
That's high praise.
Yeah, and the fact that they done this and then they got like... people to like consult from the film. Some of the actual team was on this film for consultation. Like, they actually did their homework, you know?
Right.
And that's one of the things I'd give them credit for, at least, that they make good biopics. In fact, another one, Blindside.
Yeah, the Blindside.
Was, again, if you think about it, it fit the template, didn't it?
It was definitely very, very interesting when it comes to the telling of it. However, again, you know, like with A Private War, I have like my, you know, aspersions of it being a very white savior type movie.
No, there are plenty of those, aren't there?
Hmm?
There are plenty of those films anyway.
Yeah, which I don't know. Like, I have no idea what to feel about them anymore. Like, what are we supposed to do with those kinds of films? Because I mean, they don't prove anything. Yeah.
Like, so here's my hot take on this right now. I think the world's getting tired of the whole white savior thing.
Right? And thank you.
And it's not just because, like, there are stories obviously, but there are also equally inspirational stories of other individuals from around the world. Now, a lot of people are very curious to know about stuff like that. And okay, I'll take for example, since this video game, so you play Tomb Raider, right?
I did play the first two, but I did not play Shadow.
So the third one, and I can tell you this now because the game's out for quite some time now. And we're branching into this, and I know I'm branching into video games. It's
no,
very,
please, go ahead. I mean, this is all sorts of visual storytelling.
It is visual storytelling. Yeah. And at what becomes polarized, like, everyone thought, yeah, the game's okay, it's not too bad. But what put people off, and I'll put a lot of people reviews as well. Now, keep in mind, these reviewers are also white as well, like some of them. They all agreed that the film focuses too much on Lara Croft, not as Lara Croft the Tomb Raider, Lara Croft the very wealthy British lady trying to save the world.
Well, of course.
And going to a jungle, and like they focus on that as well.
Right, which is quite weird because the second one, as opposed to the first one, by the way, the first one was definitely a little bit white saviory, but the second one kind of like went back from that, and they talked more about like someone's curiosity and someone's inner. Like, you know, moral conflict when it came to...
Yeah, like someone straight up calls her, like, stop poking your nose, you're upsetting the delicate balance of things.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's people, like, and they actually put that in there. Now, I'm not downplaying the fact that a person of a certain race or certain color is... But these stories have been told time and time and time again.
Right, exactly.
And quite frankly, like, I'm like, even... So, basically, Bohemian Rhapsody, for example, we know Freddie Mercury was Farouk Bulsara.
Yeah.
He never be liked calling his... He doesn't like... He didn't like his heritage.
Right.
He never called himself British. He never called himself of Indian descent. He was a singer at the end of the day. A showmanship. And that's what they did. And that's what I loved about it. Like, they do show scenes of this in the film.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, they focused on one thing and one thing only, is his music. And that was pretty much it. And that's what I appreciated about
it. Which I guess is credible.
Yeah. Like, they didn't go too much into, like... his ethnicity. I think for the entire duration of the film, I'd say 5 minutes was focused on that, because it was just to like showcase his roots.
Establishment?
Yeah, at best. And that, but if you look at these other films, like, they come across as, yeah, this country makes individuals of the certain caliber.
Yeah, exactly. Slumdog Millionaire, by the
absolutely,
way.
Absolutely, yeah, 100%.
We've got to talk about this, because it's just, it's bugging me so much, because, like, you know, when we talked about White Savior, the first thing that comes in my mind is this one particular scene in which, like, the protagonist is getting beaten up, and then, you know, people ask, like, oh, why? And then be like, yeah, this is India. And then they'll be like, oh, yeah, like, here's a dollar. This is America. We're Americans. We're great. And, yeah, it bothers me so much.
I mean, at the end of it, obviously, now things are changing. Like, you know, this conversation has changed. And I'm glad they are. Like, a lot of people are more or less are getting more and more stories from around the world now at this point. Because as when we talk about streaming media, a lot of what we see now is from a lot of different people. A lot of different stories are coming together. Like, the world is actually coming together in that sense, and a lot of awareness is being risen about, yeah, stories like this exist around the world, and people need to know them as well.
True. I mean, but then again, you know, I don't know. It's almost like people still want to make them, though, for some reason.
Yeah, and that's never going to change. But again, like you said, like, as long as people realize what a private war stands for that film, like, it, for me, it was deemed unnecessary, actually. I'm like, you saw the film, I haven't, and I saw the synopsis of that film, I'm like, yes, but why?
Yeah, exactly.
Great story, very brave. I can see this being a great news piece. She should be honored completely. But making a film about it, how many people are actually going to book a ticket to watch this film?
I don't know. People wanna, I guess. I don't know. It's one of those.
Like, it's a niche thing. Like, had it gone straight to TV movie, you know?
It's an Oscar friendly film, just like The Imitation Game was. And you know, most of these films are, you know, received well, but like, what kind of, you know, what kind of heft do they hold in the long run? It's not like you're gonna remember it for the rest of your life, for even a few years or months. It's just something that's so unmemorable. Like, yeah, you know her life now. You're probably going to want to research her life, which is to an extent great, but then what else does this achieve as a film?
Yeah. Like, coming on to that, though, like, now, you saw First Man, right? You still haven't watched it? We spoke about this in episode zero, actually.
Haven't watched it now, because by the time I wanted to watch it, it was out of the IMAX screens, and I was highly recommended. I was told IMAX or no.
So I watched it in non-IMAX, and I regret it, actually, to be honest. I did catch it in IMAX towards the end, but obviously because I was my mood was totally off about this film, because I'm like, I've already seen this, I know what to expect. I'm only going to enjoy the last few sequences of this film.
Because they were all, like, completely IMAX.
Now, is it a good biopic? Yes. Do I like the film? No. Now, there are two different reasons as to what is what. So, they show you that the space shuttle missions, or the moon landing missions, especially the Apollo missions specifically, was a death trap. Like, that was pretty much established. And they show that in full brutal glory, honestly. Like,
okay. And it only takes,
it's not romanticized, like, this whole space exploration thing, the beauty we see in gravity, obviously. We see the dangers as well in gravity and stuff like that, but basically
in missions like these, I guess all it takes is a man who has strong arms.
Actually, yeah, I will agree. I have no counter to say that. Yeah, I have nothing to say for that. I have nothing to say against that at all.
Success.
Ryan Gosling actually plays him well, but again, I don't like how he plays him.
Right.
And I can say a lot of things that I hate about this film, but at the end of the day, if he gets nominated for his performance as Neil Armstrong, I would not be surprised.
Well, of course. I mean, this is like you. I think you kind of said that. Said in the last.
Like, there's so many things that should have happened. This is like, okay, First Man's an art house film that shows the brutality of space.
Is it really an art house film, or is it just like a by the numbers biopic?
So here's the thing. You talk about, like, these templated biopics and stuff
like that? Yeah, like, is it Imitation Game biopic?
No, or? It's not. And that's why I say it's a very good biopic. Because at the end of it, like, again, there are very few elements. And it comes close, when I say it in terms of biopics alone, and I'm so conflicted when I say this because I don't like the film at all one bit. But is the film needed now and more than ever? Yes. We have, the space race is starting to progress right now. In terms of timing and tonal discussion of the space race, it's important now because it is that conversation is coming up right now.
By space race, do you mean the space force?
By space race, I mean the space force. Yes,
that's that's probably not really that important.
And when they were doing this film, they made it very clear that this was not about them. This was about beating another nation altogether to like be the first ones there,
right?
And a lot of things that come up in, like, because I've followed the NASA story for quite some time, even outside of mass media, like reading their books, because this is during the days that I wanted to go into like being a pilot and trying to understand the motivations of people,
right?
And that's very much captured here because they made it very clear that this whole mission is not about, oh yeah, like, we're going to the moon, we're going to make it big. No, we're going to the moon.
Speaking of pilots, by the way, we have a screensaver on our TV, and it's got a runway.
Yeah. That's why really I brought it up.
Large.
That's just why I brought it up. So, a lot of people take up these jobs not because they love it, because, like, I mean, there is passion in doing these things. Like, being an astronaut is like it's a proud moment for
the
country, but there are inherent risks. Like, you may not come back.
Yeah, from these things, of course.
And when you look at that brutality is captured. So, because when you have like there's a scene, and spoiler alert, obviously to you, unfortunately, because you haven't watched the film.
The Rotten Underdog is a spoiler-friendly platform.
So. Until I tell you, it's a big spoiler alert. If you haven't watched the film, tune off for like 2 seconds at least.
Yeah, well, you know, tune off for a while. Just I don't know.
And there's a scene where you have a pilot going to his kids. And these are like kids who are under 10.
Right.
And they say, like, you are coming back. And then the pilot is forced to tell them, look, there's a chance they may not come back.
Right.
Like, you mentally prepare them. And that is just, to see that on screen, that is just agonizing.
Yeah, of course.
And so when you look at these things in terms of capturing pure emotion, that's there. But there are also things about First Man, like, I don't like it. Like, there are long, drawn-out scenes more than they have to be. Like, I think this film is about 2 hours, 15 minutes as well. Like, the same time as A Bohemian Rhapsody in that sense, in terms of length. And a lot of it is based on the fact that it's basically, I guess it's very art-housey. It's like reflections. You see Ryan Gosling as brooding as ever. Him dealing with his own personal insecurities.
Oh, okay.
And, like, his own failures, that's all there. And, like, a lot of people can appreciate it, but I didn't. But when it comes to the environment around him, like, the other cast members, the other failed missions coming around, that's all captured beautifully. So that's why I'm very conflicted about First Man as a biopic, because great, not so good film for me, but great biopic. And then how can you tell someone that, yeah, I would recommend this because it's nice. It's a nice way to see Neil Armstrong on the big screen, but there are also other documentaries you can see as well.
True.
And that's the thing with biopics in general, really. Like, you're wearing a Gandhi shirt right now, so
yeah, which is
Ben
ironic.
Kingsley as Gandhi. So, you know.
Yeah.
It's funny because my professor was the AD on that as well.
Oh, okay.
He was my first aide, and he said, yeah, we did Gandhi, and he makes this. So I personally didn't, I mean, Gandhi was a film in its time. I don't know how to feel about that film.
Gandhi is a film that does what a biopic should do.
Yeah.
And it's what it is, you know?
Yeah.
Movies like, I don't know, Gandhi or La Bamba or, you know, all these movies based on true stories that, came out during the time didn't exactly go for a different sort of storytelling. They wanted realism. They wanted some sort of like a gravitas, and they didn't do anything different with it. There is nothing as insane or as introspective as by introspective I mean I'm talking about the First Man, the First Man themes that you explained right now. And there's nothing as insane as I, Tonya or The Wolf of Wall Street or War Dogs. War Dogs, which basically has a very Scorsese level storytelling method, or Hidden Figures and Eddie the Eagle.
Yeah,
they're all like movies, but like Gandhi was definitely like a very by the numbers movie that I don't know if it was a movie that kind of like, I don't know, established a tone for the rest of the biopics to be the kind of biopics that they are right now, or
yeah.
I have absolutely no idea. I respect it because it's a film that takes its time, but then again, I mean, my ideologies of Gandhi, which are
Gandhian. That's the term we'll be using.
My ideologies of what I think about Gandhi, which is ironic because I'm wearing a Gandhi t-shirt, isn't too good, and we're gonna stop at that because it's not so much of a political front. We're talking about biopics, and
you know what, I would like, it'll be like, I would not be surprised if we have a Stanley biopic. No?
Yeah, I mean, because look, studios want to earn money. Stanley biopic is gonna be
Bryan Cranston and Stanley. Why not?
Yeah, I think I've seen some memes. I'm not opposed to it, but also
by 20th Century Fox, that's the irony there, right there. Fox Searchlight.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't entirely be impossible, because now Fox is kind of under Disney, and Marvel is kind of
under Disney.
Yeah, so it's just kind of it's gonna be the kind of movie that that's definitely gonna go under Fox Searchlight, because
well, it has been 90 years of the House of Mouse.
Well, yeah,
90 years of Disney. I mean, not Disney per se, but like Mickey Mouse.
Well, yeah, I mean, Mickey Mouse is kind of an influential name now.
Yeah,
like, I mean, everybody knows Mickey Mouse. Everybody has spoken of Mickey Mouse at least once. I'm pretty sure even like people ahead of millennials would probably even know Mickey Mouse, because it's still it's still kind of like in conversation. It's still very popular in today's culture, which is, I guess, respectable considering a lot of cartoon characters, if we're to call them that, a lot of cartoon characters like Tom and Jerry, and
and Jerry though was Warner Brothers, right?
Yeah, but like in comparison,
right? Of course,
a lot of cartoon characters was like with Tom and Jerry or the Animaniacs, or the Warner Brothers regulars like Bugs Bunny or whatever. They didn't really take it forward as much as they could have, while Mickey's still been within the constraints of old classic cartoons.
There's still series right now. Hearts, the Kingdom Hearts series is, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Kingdom Hearts as well. Kingdom Hearts is the video game that Square Enix, right, the company, okay, did, and they made Disney into an RPG. Like, you have Goofy and Donald trying, and this is a very convoluted story in itself, but at the end of the day, they all are like warriors in the series.
Right.
And not just that, they're like not just cartoons, in fact, Mickey Mouse has his own kids series. Now we have Disney Kids as a channel, and now you can have kids mindfully stuck at their TVs looking at Disney's nursery houses, and
yeah, but like is Disney as popular as the Johnny
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. Ironically, yeah, what? It's a fun thing. I found a funny thing about that. That video was made in Dubai.
Yeah,
it was a studio in Dubai.
Our mutual friend William, who has a podcast, by the way, The Cutaway. Check it out. He told me that he just discovered at that point in time when he showed me the nightmare fuel that was
Johnny,
which is basically kind of like a rip off the Baby Shark do song.
No, I'm trying to get it out of my head. Actually, it's not hard at all. It's not easy at all to like. When I first saw it, I'm like, "What is this?"
Yeah.
Like.
Okay. Damn. Here's something that would probably help. Cool Whip.
No, Johnny's still very much stuck in me. I'm sorry.
Cool Whip. Ruined. I'm just gonna be like Stewie for a while. I don't know.
And they tried their best to take down all copies of the video and all memes that came out of this.
Oh yeah, of course.
But they didn't realize what the internet is really capable of.
Yeah, the internet's the internet.
Yeah.
Once it's on the internet, you can just never take it down.
So, speaking of things that you can never take down, streaming media. So, Disney.
Right.
With 90 years now as a mass media company, about the announcement with Disney Plus.
Right, yes.
Because that's the best name they could come up with in this scenario.
Well, I mean, Disney Plus is kind of a perfect name.
Yeah.
Disney Play would have been... a grossly overplayed,
Stars Play.
Yeah, Stars Play.
There's Stars Play. There was
There's a lot of plays and stops.
So a lot of the new shows are being developed for the format. A lot of Star Wars. Like I'm not sure how much is necessary, but it's very clear that Disney
one of the most important things about the format, or at least from what I've read, is that they're kind of like gonna break it down into different sub channels, which I'm all for, by the way.
Yeah.
I absolutely love the
idea. Would you actually buy Disney Plus? As a service.
I don't know if I would. If there is something that catches my eye, then I would. But like, you know.
No, but you wouldn't buy for one episode, one show.
No, I wouldn't probably buy, you know, just for one show. But like the whole point is that right now streaming media has kind of like broken down and has been broken down into so many different factions. Like we've got HBO Now, we've got ABC having their own television provider companion app for the US, and we've had a lot of, like, you know, there's Hulu, there's Netflix, there is the Stars, there is there's Shudder, by the way, which is also available on Amazon. There is a Sundance now. So many different streaming models that people can choose from, and I'm just a little wary about the fact that we're just gonna have some sort of like a weird concentration of this, and the competition is going to be so fierce that it's going to be impossible for anybody to win, when it comes to the numbers.
Yeah, if you think about it, like I was just mentioning earlier how Blockbuster had a chance to buy out Netflix, but they really didn't believe in it, and
right
here we are right now. Like, do you think Netflix has a reason to be worried right now?
I don't think that Netflix has a reason to be worried because Netflix is already an established established media conglomerate now. It's got some of the best originals that are there to offer, and I'm not saying this just because like, oh yeah, they've got like really big content. No, they've actually got content by filmmakers who are very passionate about what they want to do in movies, and none of the other streaming services have had that kind of gravitas when it comes to that. Sure, there's HBO, but HBO also follows the traditional TV pattern. Netflix, on the other hand, we've got like people like the Coen brothers. We've got Mike Flanagan, who's done Oculus. We've got Britt Marling, who's done a lot of fantastic indie movies. Io Origins, Another Earth. She's written The OA along with that Batman glitch. I absolutely have no idea how to pronounce that name, but yeah, it's an approximation of the name. we've had the more famous, the more older classics that are kind of like reaching their end. Or have reached their end, depending on which one. House of Cards, Orange is the New Black. There's so many Netflix originals that are really, really in it to win it. And I feel like I don't think that it needs to worry as much as it needs to, I don't know, strap itself up for a little more a little more of competitor bureaucracy or whatever.
Yeah, like you were mentioning now, like some of the originals, and you've seen a few right now. So like I've seen a new one that came out yesterday, I think, simply titled Dogs. It's a series on how man's best friend has pretty much touched the lives of several individuals, kind of on the same I'd say format as Queer Eye. Was it
what I think Siri just like kind of
yeah. When I say Queer Eye,
I found something on the web for his unall-match best friend is pretty much just the Laser 700 on the same TV format as Pereira. Take a look.
I think Queer Eye is kind of apparently Pereira now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was weird.
Yeah. So you were talking about Dogs.
Yeah. So Dogs was basically like they follow this format and they've shorted. It's a docudrama kind of format, which is amazing because it shows it's about the dogs at the end of the day, but it also shows about why there's this big fascination for the canine friends and who are like family, and it really touched my heart to like see that. See, like that's the thing that Netflix just basically adapted this straight up and they went with
right.
it. And you've seen some great original films as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And these are like, and I'm very, I'm very on the fence about original films, Netflix original movies, that because in the past there've been very like you could just count them on your fingers, like there's been Okja, and then there has been Beasts of No Nation, which is basically very few. That's just like two. Like two movies that I can count. None of the other films have been like that impactful. But come November, and we've got two movies, which are, by the way, just the best films of 2018. Some of the best films of 2018. I loved The Other Side of the Wind. Which by the way is a movie by Orson Welles, who did Citizen Kane and Touch of Evil, and this was his last film before his death that he couldn't complete. So the production team behind this, they kind of like because everything was shot, they decided to kind of get it all together and follow a lot of Orson Welles' notes and make it as much his vision as possible, which to me is fantastic. And also we get to watch a completely great movie about the lives of the rich and famous, and a parodical attempt to understand art house movies, and the kind of art house movies that are like really ambiguous and frustrating and anarchic, the way just like Jean-Luc Godard got with his later movies.
Yeah, and you also saw Ballad of Buster Scruggs as well, didn't you?
Yeah, and the Ballad of Buster Scruggs is like the Western. It was supposed to be the Western answer of Black Mirror. Which is weird, but yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be
It's shown. It's, I don't know if I'm getting this wrong or not. But it's a comedy.
Yeah, it's a comedy and drama. Like, it's got everything. In the sense that it talks about like everything between absurdist humor, life, death. It's kind of a commentary, a parody, a satire, and a drama all rolled into one. It's basically there's so many different stories. It's like an anthology film. And it was supposed to be an anthology series on Netflix until they just decided to, you know, clump it all together in the movie. And I personally feel that was just a fantastic rollercoaster ride of a movie.
By the Coen brothers, no less. Can you imagine the Coen brothers doing like something for Netflix? I was blown away, honestly. I'm like, wow, like these guys are like, we have like even Oscar-winning directors making something for the streaming format. And it's going to be so weird, though, because now we have Oscar-winning directors making a streaming format. And again, like, this is the Academy Awards and all the hubris. Like, can you see this going to a vote? Like, honestly?
Honestly, because I'm pretty sure the Ballad of Buster Scruggs has had some sort of, like, a theatrical representation before this.
Yeah.
Definitely some places around the world are having a big screen release.
Yeah.
The upcoming film Mowgli is also kind of like in this weird, place where they're going to be releasing it theatrically, and then they're going to be globally releasing it on Netflix a few weeks later. So I'm pretty sure that that's what they want to go for, because they want to qualify for the Oscars at some point. Because I feel like what the awards. The people who, you know, organize the awards, the jury, what they feel is like, you know, a streaming format service is basically just TV movie, which I feel like the definition of TV movie has kind of changed, you know, vastly, when it comes to that. So I feel like maybe that there is going to be a high chance that this could probably, like, you know, flip it completely in a different direction.
Yeah, and that pretty much sums up for us, I guess.
That definitely sums it up, unless you have anything else.
Final thoughts? Well, catch Bohemian Rhapsody as well. It's in cinemas right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think I suspect it pretty much will be this is the highlight for November. Wreck-It Ralph is coming, so I guess we'll be talking about that next.
Yeah, I guess in the special, the second special, which would probably be a 1.1.
Yep. And there's a lot of more movies to look forward to. There's we have Mowgli, we have Wreck-It Ralph, we have Into the Spider-Verse, Aquaman as well.
Yeah, Aquaman's coming in December, right?
It's both coming in
Into
December.
The Spider-Verse and Aquaman are coming.
A book coming in December. I think that will wrap up. I'm not sure which other major release is coming out in December.
Me neither.
Yeah, because I guess these are major motion pictures. I mean, and I'm sure there are a few indies releasing out as well. But as far as big cinema goes, I don't know if any other big other titles coming out for the end of the month.
No. Yeah, that's about it. I think.
But we do need to have a year-end conversation, though, because 2018 has been a great year for media.
Yes, it's been a fantastic year for a lot of different storytelling. Mediums. I think, yeah. Marvel's Spider-Man has taken the cake on PlayStation. We've got some fantastic shows on Netflix, like Maniac.
We do need to talk about Red Dead Redemption 2, because I don't think you're playing it, though.
No.
But I think you should, because if you like Battle of Buster Scruggs and you like the Western setting, because I don't personally like the Western setting.
Yeah, me neither. But that's the thing. Like I'm not a fan of the Western genre in general. But yeah. I thought that there was a wide level of whimsy in the Ballad of Buster Scruggs that completely takes it away from other different Western films.
Yeah. So I can obviously go on and on and on about Red Dead Redemption 2, but again, that's video game territory, and that's a conversation for another time in terms of narrative. But I do think a conversation about video game narratives is overdue.
Oh yeah, it is overdue, and that's why this podcast is
there. So obviously, look out for that, and thank you for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening. Do you have any dad jokes to share with me?
I don't have any cool quips.
Cool quips, nice. Cool
quips, yeah. Cool, I don't
cool,
have any.
No cool quips.
No cool whips.
But cool whips.
Cool whip. That's been the trend in the.
Yeah, so that's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. This is it from me and Kevin. Do keep listening to Rotten Underdog. Subscribe to us. We're on iTunes. We're on Spotify, Stitcher, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Anchor. You name it. So you know, wherever you listen, give us a subscribe or a follow, and you know, keep listening for more terrible lame jokes, more of me bugging Kevin.
And more cinema,
and more, yeah, and more cinema, more visual storytelling mediums. All right.